And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where I had a weekend spent at the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders conference, their annual meeting, which has been described as a capitalist Woodstock. It's an extraordinary experience, and I will tell you a little bit about it. We'll play you some highlights from the profound wisdom of this amazingly successful stock picker. And, of course, when you talk about Warren Buffett, he is more than just a stock picker. He is a whole financial philosopher. And 93 years old, and spoke for a total of about 7 hours. I mean, and it wasn't too much because it was question and answer, and it was fascinating. And 20,000 people jammed into a basketball arena in Omaha, Nebraska. And it's a kind of experience that you'll never forget. That's why people come back to these conferences for Berkshire Hathaway year after year after year after year. And the positive energy, it seems to me, was just the complete polar opposite of what you find on American college campuses, where there's just, the depressing aspect of what's going on in our colleges and universities continues. Here's some of the highlights from the New York Times. The University of Chicago, a model for free expression, is being closely watched in higher education. The arrest of a 65-year-old Dartmouth professor intensified the debate over policing on campuses. The president of the University of Chicago says an encampment cannot continue. So if it cannot continue, why is it continuing? Columbia's president urges the university to rebuild community in a video, whatever that means. After canceling the main graduation ceremony, USC announces new commencement plans. Calls to divest from Israel put students and donors on a collision course. I mean, campus protests spotlight the work of student activists and journalists. Tensions over the war in Gaza, reports the New York Times, continued to flare at American universities this week. Dozens of new arrests were made in New York, and punches were thrown between pro-Palestinian demonstrators and counter-protesters at the University of Chicago. Schools elsewhere warily tried to turn their focus toward graduation. Wouldn't that be nice? Including some of this weekend on campuses such as Northeastern and Ohio State, where demonstrations have led to arrests. Still, the wave of student activism continued to spread, including to universities outside the United States. Isn't that great? Now, with all of that going on, there is also more on the hush money trial in New York City. Though, for people who are kind of looking for excitement, and for anyone who expected that this would be the equivalent of the O.J. Simpson trial, the O.J. Simpson trial, of course, involved murder and brutal murder, basically slitting people's throats. And it clearly involved a lot of people who thought that O.J. was innocent, that he had not performed those murders. In terms of the hush money trial, the basic outline is so well documented of what Trump is accused of doing, is I'm not sure what the tension is. The tension is, will he find one member of the jury of 12 people? Will he find one member of the jury to say, no, this crime, a series of crimes that he's been talked about and accused of, not all of those crimes are proved beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard of proof that you need in felony cases like this. A witness testimony in Trump's New York hush money trial just concluded for the day, so everybody's safe until tomorrow. Two longtime Trump Organization employees walked the jury through financial documents at the heart of the charges against him, and how Michael Cohen was paid back for the money he then sent to adult star Stormy Daniels' attorney. It was $130,000. Deborah Tassaroff, who works in the accounting department at Trump's organization, explained how checks were cut to Cohen in 2017. That's while Trump was president. And testified that invoices over $10,000 had to be approved by Trump personally or by one of his sons. That's Eric or Don Jr. I don't think Barron was in the position of approving checks at that point. Earlier, former executive Jeffrey McConney testified about how Cohen's payments were listed in Trump's financial documents. And they were listed in Trump's financial documents as legal fees. But what Cohen has admitted doing was not legal work. In fact, it wasn't legal. And this is why Cohen previously was convicted and imprisoned. Prosecutors accused Trump of taking part in an illegal conspiracy to undermine the integrity of the 2016 election and an unlawful plan to suppress negative information, which included Cohen's hush money payments to Daniels. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. And he also stands accused of violating the gag order. The Judge Juan Merchan said he would hate to have to put Trump in jail. But I'm not at all sure that Trump doesn't want that to happen. Would that, if he was in prison for 4 days, which is what the possibility seems to be, would that help him in his campaign, create even more sympathy and more of the idea that he was being outrageously targeted and inappropriately targeted? Any of that could be possible. Meanwhile, there is the whole question of Cricket the dog and Kristi Noem, who has been considered to be a leading candidate for vice president. And she was asked, because she has the whole story in the book, and I don't know why, about what has to have been a terrible moment in her life of having adopted this dog and finding that the dog was useless for hunting, for which the dog had been brought, and simply did not get along with members of the family. And Kristi Noem not only said that she was right to shoot her dog dead, but suggested that President Biden should do the same thing with his dog, Commander. We will get to that, because it came out on CBS, on Face the Nation yesterday. And Kristi Noem, Face the Nation, and I think in the face of the entire nation, obliterated her realistic chances to be nominated for vice president of the United States. Meanwhile, we will get to Warren Buffett also, and some of what makes him such a unique and intensely beloved figure in American life. And why is it that people attending the, they estimate 80,000 people may have come total to Omaha for this shareholders meeting of Berkshire Hathaway? We will talk about that and more coming up on the MedVed Show.
Here's a special discount, 50% off just for being a MedHead annual member. Join today at michaelmedved.com.
And And on the Michael Medved Show, according to Pew Research, most Americans, 62%, own a pet. Now, most of those pets are dogs or cats, but that also includes goldfish and turtles and birds and you name it. But 35% of Americans have more than one pet. And nearly all U.S. pet owners, 97%, say their pets are part of the family. This according to a new Pew Research Center survey. About half of pet owners, 51%, not only consider their pets to be a part of their family, but say they are as much a part of their family as a human family member. Which is why Kristi Noem probably made a profound political mistake to talk about shooting her dog. I mean, come on. If you remember, there was a huge attempt by Democrats to smear Mitt Romney because he had built an enclosure. He took a family trip. It was a driving trip with his five sons. And I actually had... I asked Ann Romney about this when she was on the radio show. And Ann Romney, Mrs. Mitt Romney, talked about their dog, who was an Irish setter, who was fine afterward. He seemed to enjoy the trip, riding on top of the car in this enclosure and going along with the family rather than staying home in some kind of pet hotel. In any event, this item involving Kristi Noem, that goes beyond Mitt Romney's trip with his dog on the roof of his car, because the dog didn't end up happily. Here is what the interchange sounded like on Face the Nation. This is clip 11.
Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said killing the dog and then writing about it ended any possibility of her being picked as VP. You talk multiple times about it. In fact, at the end of the book, you say the very first thing you would do if you got to the White House that was different from Joe Biden is you'd make sure Joe Biden's dog was nowhere on the grounds. Commander, say hello to Cricket. Are you doing this to try to look tough? Do you still think that you have a shot at being a VP?
Well, number one, Joe Biden's dog has attacked 24 Secret Service people. So how many people is enough people to be attacked and dangerously hurt before you make a decision on a dog and what to do with it?
Well, he's not living at the White House anymore.
That's a question that the president should be held accountable to.
You're saying he should be shot?
That's what the president should be accountable to, is what is the number? And I would say about Republicans criticizing me, these are the same Republicans that criticized me during COVID. They've criticized me when I've made other decisions in South Dakota to protect my state. And my state today is extremely happy and thriving. We're doing well. We've got thousands of people moving to our state because they love the opportunities that are here and the businesses that have come.
Okay. Nice effort to change the subject. But I mean, really, the fact that she wants to feature in her book the idea that she was tough enough to put down Cricket, the 14-month-old. It was a short-haired pointer dog that was not a good hunter. Let us imagine that I think that what Newt Gingrich said is true, is that this is going to make it very controversial, very difficult for President Trump to select Kristi Noem as his running mate. Meanwhile, somebody who doesn't have that problem at all because of his phenomenal popularity is Warren Buffett. I would never have thought to go to the shareholders meeting in Omaha. I've heard about it before, and it is a huge festival atmosphere, and it dominates the whole city, and Omaha is a surprisingly nice, pleasant, and well-run city with no homeless encampments to be seen, no graffiti. It is a clean, workable, livable city with some beautiful neighborhoods, including the neighborhood where Mr. Buffett, at age 93, still lives in the same home he bought many, many years ago for $31,000. The festivities began with a movie, and it's always a movie that they say they're not going to show elsewhere. But it was a movie that was largely a tribute to Warren Buffett's longtime partner, the vice president of Berkshire Hathaway, Charlie Munger, who had worked with Buffett for some 50 years. And it began with some of Charlie Munger's most memorable moments and comments. Listen.
Competency is a relative concept. And what a lot of us need, including the one speaking, is what I needed to get ahead was to compete against idiots. And luckily, there's a large supply.
And accounting, you can do things like they do in Italy when they have trouble with the mail. You know, it piles up and irritates the postal employees. They just throw away a few carloads and then they're...
That happened in some unnamed international country.
Yeah, Italy.
It's perfectly obvious, at least to me, that to say that derivative accounting in America is a sewer is an insult to sewage.
People don't seem to get that point. You have any idea why, Charlie?
Warren, if people weren't so often wrong, we wouldn't be so rich.
No.
If I can be optimistic when I'm nearly dead, surely the rest of you can handle a little inflation.
Charlie Munger passed away at age 99, and Warren Buffett was teasingly commenting that, well, he couldn't even make it to 100. Why? And he's 93 now. And during the session, a young boy asked Warren Buffett if he had one more day with his best friend and partner, Charlie Munger, what would he do with him? Listen to the response.
My name is Ange Andronikis, and I'm wondering, if you had one more day with Charlie, what would you do with him?
Well, it's kind of interesting because, in effect, I did have one more day. I mean, it wasn't a full day or anything, but we always lived in a way where we were happy with what we were doing every day. I mean, Charlie had... He was interested in more things than I was, but we never had any doubts about the other person, period. And so if I'd had another day with him, we'd probably have done the same thing we were doing the earlier days, and we wouldn't have wanted another. We only had one day. there's a great advantage in not knowing what day you're going to die. Charlie always said, you know, that just tell me where I'm going to die, so I'll never go there. Well,
there's more. He was asked at one point, who would you spend the last day of your life with? What a terrible thing to ask a 93-year-old. He gave a brilliant answer. We'll get to it coming up on The Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
Bit more about the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders conference that took place in Omaha, Nebraska. It takes place in Omaha every year because that's where Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett are from. They actually knew each other in junior high school or middle school, as it's now called. And they were separated because Charlie Munger's father was elected a congressman. He was a conservative Republican congressman, Howard Buffett. And Warren was never particularly interested in politics, still isn't. And he was interested in building wealth, which he has been very clear he intends to continue to give away at a prodigious rate. If you believe, as many Christians and Jewish people believe, that charity is one of the highest obligations that people can have, I mean, Buffett has been so extraordinary with his charitable giving. One of the things he was asked near the very end of the conference that took place this weekend is the 93-year-old CEO and somebody whose personal wealth is estimated to be $167 billion. That's even having given away a great deal of his money already and committing to give away more to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill Gates was there at this conference. But he was asked by one of the participants in this huge and eager and positive audience, full of hope and energy, and really the opposite of what you're getting on college campuses right now. He was asked a question that had nothing to do, really, with investing. Listen, clip 10.
What you should probably ask yourself is that, who do you feel that you'd want to start spending the last day of your life with, and then figure out a way to start meeting them tomorrow and meet them as often as you can? That's the why wait until the last day? Don't bother with the others.
He was asked about who he would want to spend the last day of his life with. Then there were so many young people from all over the world, from Asia very visibly, a lot of Germans who were there. We spent time with a young man from Argentina. There were some Israelis. There were people from everywhere. And there was a young man from Thailand who got to ask a question about investing. That's clip 13.
Good afternoon, Mr. Buffett, Mr. Abel. My name is Sirapop Wu, a resident of New Zealand, but originally from Thailand. This is my first time in America and the first time attending the meeting. The journey was quite rough, but it was all worth it, though, because I can now personally thank you, Mr. Buffett, and the late Charlie Munger, while he's still with us, for organizing such a wonderful event, and most importantly, for being such an exceptional role models and sharing your wisdom with us all these years. So thank you.
Well, thank you for coming.
And then he asked a question.
Towards the end of 2018, you mentioned that you guarantee you could make a 50% annual return if you had to start again with under $1 million. The question is, if tomorrow you woke up in the body of
your body.
20-year-old American,
your body.
What method or methods would you use to achieve that return? Would it involve flipping through 20,000 pages of Moody's manual or similar publications?
Yep. In my particular case, it would be going through the 20,000 pages.
And basically, he talks about the details that you can learn from the 20,000 pages. One of the things that is extraordinary, and it does say something about the prosperity of this country and the blessed nature of this country, he began to help people with their investments in 1955, long time ago. If somebody had invested $1,000 in 1955 with Warren Buffett and with Berkshire Hathaway, what would that be equal to today in 2024? Okay, so remember, you're starting with $1,000. It would be equal to $42.5 million, which is for people who bemoan the state of American life, the conference of Berkshire Hathaway shareholders is a fine anecdote. And I do want to thank Selwyn Gerber, who runs a terrific company called RVW Investments, who was responsible for bringing Diane and I to enjoy this extraordinarily memorable event. And the idea that the business of America is business, said Calvin Coolidge, President Calvin Coolidge, and there is a brighter and more positive side to American business than many people recognize. There was also a powerful letter that was written today that I wanted to share part of it with you. It was written by Rabbi Moshe Hauer, who is the executive vice president of the Orthodox Union, which is the largest Orthodox Jewish body in the country. And he wrote the post-October 7th campus climate, where rallies extol and promote Hamas, predictably produces violence. How could the FBI not monitor protests when they were clearly the breeding ground for more of this violence? And he talks about having this conversation with an FBI agent who was very friendly and he was very supportive. But the agent said look, they can't because the rabbi asked, are you investigating what is happening with these protesters afterward and any plans that they have for further violence? And he said those charged with law enforcement in this country are nothing like those university professors, department heads, and DEI officers who have defined Jews and Israelis as privileged and powerful white colonizers. They are not to be lumped together with the virtuous champions of human and women's rights, except for those of Jews. And they are certainly not to be compared with the many large Muslim American groups who have yet to condemn the actions of Hamas on October 7th and are nevertheless invited to weigh in on the evils of Islamophobia. And what he says is what we have seen too often in the government response to the continued anarchy on campus is the very opposite, a government with all the power and the tools but lacking the courage. We tried it before, they say, and it did not end well. Is the lesson of the campus protests of the 60s that law enforcement must always stand down? Well, there's a different answer. We will get to that and to more coming up on the MedVet Show.
Here's a special discount, 50% off just for being a MedHead annual member. Join today at michaelmedved.com.
Your outlet for outrage.
It's outrageous what's going on out here.
It's the Michael Medved Show.
It is a tremendous, tremendous thing, and I'm telling you, it's going to explode.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the show, I was sharing a letter. It's a heartfelt and concerning letter from the executive vice president of the Orthodox Union in the United States. His name is Rabbi Moshe Hauer. And by the way, let me acknowledge a mistake that I made earlier in the show when I described Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is today, as Yom HaZikaron. Yom HaZikaron is actually Memorial Day in Israel. This is Yom HaShoah. It's not the day of remembrance, but it's specifically Holocaust Remembrance Day. And he writes, Rabbi Hauer, today is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. The choice to mark this day during the Jewish month that we're in, which is the month we're just leaving, was the month of Nisan. That choice was made because of the desire to include in our commemoration of the Holocaust the courage of the Warsaw Ghetto resistance fighters whose rebellion was initiated on Passover. Theirs is a story of people who courageously stood up to evil, but whose powerlessness made their effort doomed to fail. What we have been seeing too often in the government response to the continued anarchy on campus is the very opposite. A government with all the power and the tools, but lacking the courage. We tried it before, they say, and it did not end well. If the lesson of the campus protests of the 60s and the BLM rallies of 2020, that law enforcement must always stand down? Must we allow violent rallies because we are fearful of being accused of suppressing the truly sacred right of peaceful protest? Does our concern for police overreach move us to handcuff law enforcement? Does our sensitivity to racism and Islamophobia justify our acceptance of Islamically driven hatred and violent anti-Semitism? As we mark this Yom HaShoah, he writes, we note how blessed we are to live in this country, where our leaders are dedicated to addressing the growing scourge of anti-Semitism, and where government and law enforcement agencies listen to us, work with us, and share deeply our concerns and our fears. What we tried once before in the 60s did not end well, but the strategy of choosing not to get involved in demonstrations does not seem to be ending well either. To learn the lessons of history, we must try it again and do it better, aiming to get it right by preventing violence without throttling peaceful protest. As Jews read from the Torah in Leviticus 19:17 today, you shall not stand by when the blood of your fellow is threatened. We appreciate sincerity, but we need courage. That's the letter by Rabbi Hauer. Speaking about the lessons, however, then confronting some of the more radical demonstrations, historian Michael Beschloss made a reasonable point on MSNBC regarding the desire, which was also at this time in May in 1970, to take some lessons from the Kent State horrors. Listen, clip 7.
Lessons should today's leaders take from what happened at Kent State 54 years ago today?
Well, the lesson from Kent State, of course, I think, Christina, and you would both agree, is, you know, never use military force to try to stop a demonstration that's peaceful. And those National Guard troops were sent in by the governor of Ohio, James Rhodes, 4 killed, 5 wounded. It was a national tragedy. And even Richard Nixon, who was the one who had waged that invasion of Cambodia that caused this protest, he had enough of a heart that he went into what looks like an emotional breakdown, could not sleep, got up at about 4 in the morning before dawn, called for his car, went with his valet to the Lincoln Memorial where students were protesting and tried to engage them by talking about sports. Didn't work too well, but it did show that Nixon was not entirely stone-faced.
Okay, the one thing that Michael Beschloss is missing here, and it was something I actually remember because I was in law school at the time, having an argument about this with people in law school, because the truth about Kent State was, of course, it was a tragedy, and of course those 4 kids did not deserve to die. However, the crowd was throwing rocks and bottles at the National Guardsmen. And you cannot basically, when you are being approached and trying to be, because there was occupation of buildings and the crowds had gone fairly crazy. But there is no question that the National Guard were provoked. And And the same way that they do not come in to do their job to try to restore order to a very fraught civilization without the expectation that they're not going to be injured by bricks and bottles and rocks and other things that were thrown at them. And that's important not to misremember when you talk about that terrible incident at Kent State, which horrified the country. Something else that electrified the country not too long after that was the Star Wars series of movies. And they just re-released with great success the first installment of the Phantom Menace, of the last series of Star Wars. And the second of that sequence came out in 2015, and that was Star Wars The Force Awakens. And here's the way we reviewed it at the time.
Now, it's time for Medvid on Movies.
Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher are back as Han Solo and Princess Leia, but a new character, Rey, played by the excellent Daisy Ridley, is the chief heroine of Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
There are stories about what happened.
The dark side, a Jedi, it's true, all of it.
And it's true, this new Star Wars installment broke records in every galaxy, earning over $1 billion in its first 10 days of release. In part because director, co-writer J.J. Abrams captures the energetic, awestruck, gee-whiz spirit of the original film from nearly 40 years ago.
Nothing will stand in our way. I will finish what you started.
I was raised to do one thing, but I've got nothing to fight for.
The Force, it's calling to you. Just let it in.
And yes, it's hard to resist that force. Even though there's nothing terribly deep, there's nothing deeply disappointing. This is an undeniably enjoyable film with nifty special effects and appealing new characters played by John Boyega, Oscar Isaac, and of course Daisy Ridley. If some of the melodrama seems a bit derivative, even repetitive, Star Wars fans will revel in rather than reviling the consistency. Rated PG-13 for science fiction violence and some surprises that may be too harsh for very young viewers. 3.5 stars for Star Wars The Force Awakens, which mostly deserves its huge success.
And coming up tomorrow, speaking of huge success, there has just been an amazing decision statement by 13 federal judges. They have all pledged not to hire from Columbia Law School. That's in order to take their clerks from Columbia Law School. They call it an incubator of bigotry. Ouch. Meanwhile, The Atlantic magazine asks, is Donald Trump trying to get thrown into jail? I had raised precisely that same question because obviously if you look at the pattern, maybe that could help him politically. Something that will help no one politically is Canada's wacko drug policy, decriminalization without incentives to get clean. It's destroying life in public spaces, as reported in the Wall Street Journal. And the fact is, the Gaza protests are nothing like those protests in Vietnam. We have a unique element. That unique element is self-loathing of the United States. And MIT has become the first elite university to ban diversity statements, no longer requiring statements by its faculty hiring process. That's a remarkable development and a positive one, of course, for this greatest nation on God's green earth.